If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
The man known to history as Frank Costello was born on the 26th of January 1891 as Francesco Castiglia in Lauropoli, a small hill town near Cassano allo Ionio in the Calabria region of southern Italy, right in the northwestern corner of the Gulf of Taranto, between the boot and the heel of the peninsula. As we will see, the name Frank Costello was one he assumed many years later while in New York. Castiglia's father was Don Luigi Castiglia, a poor farmer who was 45 years of age already at the time that Francesco was born. Even by the standards of the crippling poverty which characterized southern Italy in the second half of the 19th century, he was a man of little means and the family often went without many of the basic necessities of life. Francesco's mother was Maria, a woman who worked as a midwife on occasion to try to make extra money for the family. And it was a large family. Francesco was Luigi and Maria's sixth child. When he was born, he already had four older sisters and one brother named Eduardo, who from 5 years of age was spending more time helping his father on the farm than attending school. It was not just the Castiglias that were poor, so were virtually every other family in Calabria at the time, and this poverty was replicated all across Italy to varying degrees. In an age of mass migration from Europe to the Americas, as the introduction of modern medicine and other innovations saw population rates boom, the Italian diaspora was in a world of its own. 15 million people or so left the peninsula in the half century between Italian unification in 1861 and the outbreak of the First World War in 1914. The birth of Francesco, bringing their brood to six, seems to have been the spur for Luigi Castiglia to join the exodus. He left for America in 1893. Like many such migrant families from Italy, they did not all leave at once. Luigi went with Eduardo and two of their daughters, while Maria stayed behind with the other two daughters and little Francesco. When he arrived in New York City, the entry point for so many Italians to the United States, Luigi stayed with relatives and worked. Yet it still took 2 years to raise enough money to send back two steamship tickets to Maria in Italy. With these, she set off with one of her daughters and Francesco, who traveled for free as he was still so young. One daughter was left behind with relatives. In New York City, the almost fully reunited family lived in a three-story tenement building at 236 East 108th Street in East Harlem, at a time before the Great Migration had begun to fully transform Harlem into an African-American-dominated part of New York. Instead, in the 1890s, this was a microcosm of Italy, where one was more likely to hear Italian than English being spoken. Here, the Castiglias eked out a living, with Luigi opening a hole-in-the-wall grocery store that sold the basics – milk, flour, bread, eggs, nothing fancy. They just about made enough money to put food on the table, but Francesco and Eduardo supplemented their diet by robbing pushcarts on the streets. People who knew him decades later recounted how Frank hated it if anybody took food from a plate he was eating from. It was a hang-up from his early years, when nothing came easy and the family were often hungry. Francesco was also late in starting school, delayed by his lack of English on arrival in America. He didn't like it when he did start, and he and Eduardo were soon much more interested in skipping classes to to hold a craps game they organized amongst the other kids in East Harlem. Meanwhile, he grew to despise the family's poverty, confessing in later life to a psychiatrist that he had hated his father. He couldn't understand why he had just accepted the poverty into which he had been cast by the circumstances of birth. There was, of course, an alternative route for those who didn't want to live in crippling poverty, whether back in the old country or in New York. Criminal syndicates such as the Sicilian Mafia or Cosa Nostra, Our Thing in English, and the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta dated back to the 18th century in Italy, when they emerged through their efforts to rob from and undermine the Bourbon monarchy and the elites that surrounded it in the Kingdom of Naples. Often in the 19th century, such organizations focused on controlling the trade in cash crops, such as lemons, across Sicily and southern Italy. These organizations soon emerged in the US as the diaspora community there ballooned in size from the 1860s onwards. Newspapers reported on Sicilian mobsters operating in New Orleans as early as 1869. But crime in many US cities was often controlled by Irish gangs for much of the second half of the 19th century. The Irish had begun arriving in terrible poverty to America in large numbers from as early as the 1830s, giving them a head start on the Italian communities. However, by the time Francesco was coming of age in the 1900s, Italian criminals and gangs were becoming significant players in the New York underworld, sometimes in direct competition with, and at other times working alongside, Irish-American gangs, and gangs of Jewish Americans who had left the Russian Empire in large droves in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to escape growing anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe and regular famines there. Francesco, who was now generally going by Frank or Frankie, as his name was anglicized by many people in New York, entered this world of crime from his teenage years onwards, much like many others who were household names in the history of the Italian Mafia today. He did so gradually. At first, when he left school as a teenager, he got a job working at a piano factory. He quit this before long in distaste for lugging pianos up staircases around New York at a time when health and safety rules were non-existent, and the term backbreaking work meant exactly that. Instead, he returned to petty crime, for a time focusing on breaking open vending machines around the East Side and relieving them of the stash of cent coins inside. His exploits escalated from there. In April 1908, he was arrested for the first time after he and some others robbed a coal merchant of $17.50 on Washington Avenue, an operation during which Costello hit the man in the head with a hammer. Miraculously, the charges were dropped and he walked free. The same thing happened when he was next arrested in 1912 for robbing a woman of approximately $2,000 worth of jewelry and other valuables near his family home. Perhaps he escaped punishment on this second occasion because the judge did not realize he had previously been before the courts in 1908. By 1912, Frank was spelling his name Castello or Costello, and the judge might not have realized it was the same person. Indeed, Frank's decision to start going by this name seems to have begun with his using it as a criminal alias in the early 1910s, and it became a name that simply stuck. He would be known by it forever after. The mid-1910s were perhaps the most formative years for Costello. He and his brother graduated from low-level street crime around 1914 to working as go-betweens at the New York docks, forcing people who wanted to get a day's precarious work as a stevedore, unloading and loading cargo, to pay them a finder's fee. The overseer would then pick them from amongst the individuals who had shown up that day. At the same time, he met Lori Geigerman, the sister of a friend and a woman who was known to everyone as Bobby. A relationship soon began, and in September 1914, they were married. She was probably only 15 years of age at the time, though she stated she was 19 on the marriage license. After the wedding, Costello got them an apartment in West Harlem and continued to try rising in New York's criminal underworld. But marital bliss was soon disturbed. In March 1915, he was arrested on gun possession and ended up before a judge again. This time he gave his name as Frank Saverio, using his mother's maiden name. However, this judge was a better investigator and told Costello's lawyer that this was his third time before a court after the incidents in 1908 and 1912, using a different name on each occasion. He sentenced Costello to 1 year in prison, and he was shipped off to what was then known as Welfare Island, today's Roosevelt Island, to the east of Midtown Manhattan. Costello was released from prison in 1916, after serving 11 months. He almost immediately returned to a life of petty crime and remained stuck at this level for much of the remainder of the 1910s. For instance, in May 1919, he was arrested with two others for robbing a man named Peter Moreo of just $100 in a park in Queens. He escaped on this occasion without a sentence and moved briefly into a gambling craze, playing punchboard, which soon fizzled out. It might have continued like this for Costello, but in January 1920, his fortunes changed enormously when the US government banned the sale and supply of alcohol. Overnight, he and hundreds of other small-time criminals in New York began setting up operations to produce, transport, and supply bootleg alcohol to illegal bars and speakeasies all over New York and the wider tri-state area. He was soon moving in circles with other young criminals who would become some of the leading figures in American crime of the mid-20th century. Italians like Charles Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese, and the most senior figure in Italian crime for much of the 1920s, Joe the Boss Masseria, as well as Jewish mobsters like Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. At the top of the pyramid was Arnold Rothstein, a Jewish American who had interests all over the East Coast in gambling, bootlegging, and many other nefarious enterprises. Frank and his brother largely started out working with Rothstein in the early 1920s, using some capital he provided them with to set up their own bootlegging enterprise and then paying him a cut of the profits. In the early days of Prohibition, this was easily done. There were huge government warehouses where alcohol was stored, either having been confiscated or for supply to pharmacies and doctors, as alcohol could still be sold for medicinal purposes. Bribes could quite easily be paid to get access to some of this government booze. Later, as the warehouses emptied out, the Costellos and figures like Luciano, Genovese, and Lansky had to turn to other sources. By the mid-1920s, they were involved in taking delivery of large consignments of booze, which came in on boats along the Jersey shore, in a region which became known as Rum Row, away from the prying eyes of New York's police. Consignments were also run down from Canada. By the middle of the decade, the operation was so sophisticated that an exchange was being run in Little Italy, where someone like Costello, who had too much whiskey, for instance, but not enough rum for his clients, could swap different types of booze with someone else. This exchange and many other locations around New York also became social settings, in which the disparate gangs and outfits of Italian, Irish, and Jewish criminals who had operated in isolation around Manhattan and the wider city prior to 1920 came together and coordinated their efforts. Organized crime in the US was lent an enormous hand by Prohibition. It certainly was the making of Frank Costello. It wasn't all amicable, though. There were perennial conflicts and minor gang wars across the 1920s as one group impeded onto what another group perceived as their turf or sphere of influence. Costello was involved in such conflicts early on, and as well as forging a more organized group of gangs in New York, Prohibition also soon saw small-time criminals like Costello turn into gunmen who were known for killing individuals. Alliances were needed. After getting his start with Rothstein, Costello was soon closely tied to Big Bill Dwyer, a leading Irish bootlegger whom he started working with in 1923. Leading to the mistaken assumption that he changed his name to Costello around this time to make his name sound Irish. The Dwyer-Costello partnership became one of the most successful in New York in the mid-1920s, and soon made Costello enormously wealthy. Police records, for instance, indicated that Dwyer probably made around $10 million between 1922 and 1929, a sum equivalent to about $200 million in today's money. If Costello made even a quarter of that out of their partnership, he was made for life and then some. Moreover, as Costello's cash accumulated, he began investing in a wide range of other business interests. One of these was Costello Realty Company, which bought up land in the Bronx and built houses on it, while nearby in the same neighborhood, the Frank Costello Auto Company was selling cars by the end of the 1920s. Some ventures indicated how unglamorous many criminal enterprises could be. For example, the Dainties Products Company, which Costello set up with an old friend, Harry Horowitz, sold chocolate ice cream cones. It served its purpose, though, and helped explain to the taxman where at least some of his newfound wealth was coming from. One story concerning Costello during these years that has always intrigued people concerns his alleged ties to Joseph Kennedy Sr., the patriarch of the Kennedy political family and father of President John F. Kennedy and the senators Robert Kennedy and Edward Kennedy. Kennedy was a notable New England businessman by the time that Prohibition began. There is no doubting at the same time that he exited the 1920s a lot richer than he began it, leading to suspicions he was involved in bootlegging. Costello claimed in later life that he and Bill Dwyer were associates of Kennedy, and they weren't the only New York bootleggers who made claims of this kind. These days, historians tend to argue that the Kennedy claims are probably erroneous, but at least one biography of Costello notes an incident in the late 1940s when a lawyer of Frank's attended his house in New York. When he got there, Costello was on the phone, and when he hung up, the lawyer asked him who he had been talking to. Costello responded, "Oh, just that Kennedy fella from Boston." Whether this indicates Kennedy was an old bootlegging acquaintance from the 1920s, or if this was just an example of how entangled politicians and organized crime figures could be in America in the middle of the 20th century is unclear. In 1928, New York's criminal politics shifted dramatically. On the 4th of November 1928, Arnold Rothstein was shot in New York and died 2 days later. He had refused to pay off a huge amount of money he had lost in a gambling session, amounting to around a third of $1 million. Rothstein could have easily paid it off, but believed the game of poker in which he had been involved was rigged. His death left a major vacuum in the New York underworld. Rothstein had in many ways been the glue which held much of the illegal activity here over the 1920s together, financing small-bit operators like Costello at the start of Prohibition and in the process allowing for their emergence as major gangsters. Furthermore, he had a finger in every criminal activity going, from gambling to bootlegging and even into fraudulent insurance and treasury bonds. With his death, his empire was divided up by a large number of different people, with a number of the leaders of Italian crime families such as Joe the Boss Masseria and Lucky Luciano emerging stronger than ever. Costello moved closer to both Masseria and Luciano in the months that followed, but Rothstein's death also sowed the seeds of future conflicts. By early 1930, a feud was brewing between the different gangs and criminal families across New York. In particular, there was an imminent clash between Joe the Boss Masseria, who Costello, Luciano, and Genovese were closely aligned with, and an emerging upstart, Salvatore Maranzano, who had arrived to New York from Sicily back in 1925. Matters came to a head when Masseria ordered Luciano and Genovese to murder Gaetano Reyna, a former associate of theirs, in February 1930 after he started working for Maranzano. This resulted in an all-out conflict, known as the Castellammarese War, after the town of Castellammarese del Golfo in Sicily, where Maranzano and several of his closest associates hailed from. The war lasted for 14 months, before Luciano, Costello, and Genovese betrayed Masseria and murdered him. Thereafter, Maranzano declared himself to be the capo di tutti capi, the boss of bosses, and that each of the crime families around New York and the tri-state area should henceforth pay him tribute. This proved unacceptable to Luciano, Costello, and Genovese, and fearing that Maranzano was going to have them killed in September 1931, they moved preemptively and hired some Jewish hitmen to murder Maranzano at his office in Park Avenue in Manhattan on the 10th of September. This left Luciano and by extension figures like Costello and Genovese in an unprecedented position of power. In the aftermath of the Castellammarese War and the brief rule of Maranzano as the boss of bosses, Luciano might well have been able to claim a position as his successor. Yet when the heads of the many Italian-American crime outfits met in Chicago sometime later for a meeting which Luciano had called, a different approach was taken. Luciano advised that a commission should be set up, consisting of the heads of the five families or leading crime outfits in New York, plus the heads of the mafia in Buffalo and Chicago. The seven-man commission would be chaired by Luciano. However, he turned down the position of boss of bosses, stating later that it would have just led to jealousy and would have made him a marked man within a short period of time. Thus, the commission was established late in 1931 as the new governing body for the Italian mafia. Luciano absorbed some of the Maranzano family operations into the Luciano crime family. He would head it, with Genovese as his second in command, with Costello acting as consigliere or counselor, a lead advisor or right-hand man to Luciano. As the mafia settled down in a period of peace and cooperation after the Castellammarese War and the downfall of Maranzano, the end of Prohibition was looming as the government conceded that it had not worked and had led to intense levels of criminality across the country. The mafia needed to diversify in response as the bootlegging trade came to an end in 1933. One of the major areas of expansion thereafter was gambling, with all manner of games expanded on, notably slot machines, many of which were being acquired by the mob in Chicago and sent to New York. These occupied a grey area legally, seeming like games of chance of some kind rather than actual gambling, and they proliferated in the early 1930s. The distribution of these around New York and of other types of gambling was central to Costello's lines of income as Prohibition came to an end. Accordingly, it was particularly troubling for him when Fiorello LaGuardia was elected as the mayor of New York in 1933 and began his term at the start of 1934 with a major crackdown on gambling, slot machines included. Costello would find a solution in an unlikely location, which points towards the spread tentacles of the Italian-American mafia in the 1930s. In the aftermath of LaGuardia's crackdown, Costello had an estimated $1 million worth of slot machines sitting in warehouses in New Jersey, having moved them out of New York. Early in 1935, he came to an incredible arrangement concerning them with one of the Great Depression era's more colorful characters. Huey Long, known as the Kingfisher, was the most powerful politician in Louisiana, serving as governor there between 1928 and 1932, before heading to Washington as Louisiana state senator. There he became one of the leading opponents of President Roosevelt's New Deal, but unlike most others who critiqued Roosevelt for being a socialist, Long claimed Roosevelt wasn't going far enough in his left-wing policies. Long's arrangement with Costello was for him to bring his slot machines down from the tri-state area to the bayou. Thus, in the spring of 1935, about 1,000 mafia slot machines were installed in various locations around New Orleans, in an arrangement whereby Costello would pay Long $40,000 a year towards New Orleans charities. It was a peculiar arrangement, which brought in a lot of money for Costello. It wasn't a good look for Long, a heavy drinker who was known for courting controversy, and was assassinated just a few months later owing to a bitter Louisiana political rivalry. The slot machine business continued though in New Orleans, with Phil Castell running it for Costello on the ground in New Orleans. It's believed that it brought in over $1 million in some good years, up until it was gradually shut down by state authorities from 1951 onwards. Just a year after he installed his lucrative slot machines across New Orleans, Costello moved up the rung in the Luciano crime family. Early in 1936, a series of massive raids was launched on the brothels across Manhattan and other parts of New York. In the days that followed, it became clear that the special state prosecutor who oversaw the operation, Thomas Dewey, was primarily targeting Luciano. Charges were pressed and Charles was picked up hiding in Arkansas. Sent back to New York, he was immediately placed on trial and convicted weeks later of pandering. The trial became a bigger case than the charges warranted, with Dewey effectively prosecuting a case that Luciano had been engaged in serious criminal activity for the last 20 years. When the sentencing came, he was given 30 to 50 years in prison. Sent upstate to Dannemora prison, Vito Genovese was chosen to act as head of the Luciano crime family, while Lucky appealed his unlucky sentence. In reality, Genovese was now in charge. But he too was quickly under investigation, and in the spring of 1937, he fled from the US to Italy as the possibility of murder charges appeared, relating to an incident in 1934. With this extraordinary sequence of events, Costello found himself unexpectedly stepping into the role of acting boss of the Luciano crime family in the middle of 1937. As acting boss of the Luciano crime family, Costello brought a different approach to many other Italian mobsters of the 1920s and 1930s. Although he had started out as a low-level street hoodlum back in the late 1900s and 1910s, Costello had matured over the years into a consummate businessman. Unlike Genovese and many other heads of the New York families that would follow in the course of the 20th century, he believed business should be conducted quietly and discreetly. He didn't like violence either, and even at the height of the Castellammarese War back in 1930, he had repeatedly counseled Masseria to seek peace terms with Maranzano, but to no avail. His approach from 1937 onwards mirrored this. He kept people in line and developed the mafia's already well-established political links with politicians operating out of Tammany Hall, the political machine which had dominated New York politics since the middle of the 19th century. A sign of this low-key approach would be seen in the late 1940s, when he effectively tried to ban his underlings from selling narcotics. Believing this would eventually bring too much governmental and police scrutiny down on them, yet there were always issues to be dealt with. In 1937, he made Willie Moretti, a friend of his since they were teenagers together on the East Side, his second in command. But within a few years, Moretti's actions became troublesome as he began to suffer from advanced syphilis, the same condition which reduced Al Capone to the mental capacity of a child before he died in 1947. Eventually, many years later, Moretti would have to be killed before he revealed anything to the police, as his conduct became more and more dangerous. Much of Costello's time as acting head of the Luciano crime family was dominated by the peculiar situation which world events more broadly placed the Italian mafia in during the first half of the 1940s. In 1937, the Japanese had launched a wide-ranging invasion of eastern China, which saw the main ports there occupied down to the mid-1940s. China had been the main source of opium arriving to the United States for processing for decades, and with this, new trade routes were cultivated, particularly the French connection through factories on the island of Corsica and the French port city of Marseille. Costello was involved in overseeing this period of transition. Then, in the autumn of 1939, Europe ended up being hit by war as Nazi Germany invaded Poland, beginning the Second World War. The United States avoided becoming involved in the conflict until it was attacked without a declaration of war by the Japanese in December 1941. In the months that followed, the government of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt committed to defeating the Germans before focusing on the war in the Pacific against the Japanese. The first major campaign was launched to North Africa, where a German expeditionary force, the Afrika Korps, was trying to secure the Suez Canal from Britain with the aid of its ally, Benito Mussolini's Italy. By the spring of 1943, the Western Allies would have virtually driven the Germans and Italians out of North Africa and began preparing for an invasion of Sicily and southern Italy to open a southern front in Europe. As they did so, the US government began considering how the Italian mafia, so many of the heads of which, like Costello, Luciano, and Genovese, had been born in Italy and still had contacts there, could be of use in the coming assault on the fascist regime back in the old country. What is unofficially known as Operation Underworld commenced in the spring of 1942, as Luciano was moved to a more comfortable prison near New York City, as the Italian-American mafia began cooperating with the government. Luciano was apparently central to establishing ties between the government and the Sicilian mafia, ones which aided in the swift conquest of Sicily in the summer of 1943. Costello, though, was primarily engaged in aiding the administration in New York, where there was a considerable interest in managing the labor unions and the port in ways which would benefit the government. Nobody needed labor problems occurring in the midst of a world war, or spies slipping in through one of the country's largest ports. The arrangement involved figures like Costello visiting Luciano regularly once he was moved to Great Meadows Prison, and there they would give him information which Luciano then passed on to federal agents who would come and consult with him. Costello was seemingly particularly useful in passing on info regarding developments on Long Island. Exactly how useful any of this information was, if at all, has remained a matter of debate. But it was considered significant enough that when Luciano applied for early release at the end of the war, his application was granted, with the stipulation that he was to be deported from the United States back to Italy. He was released and sent on his way in February 1946. Thus, although Luciano had miraculously escaped from the American penal system after serving just 9 years out of a 30 to 50 year sentence, Costello was to remain as the head of the most powerful of New York crime families. In the summer of 1945, as the war in Europe was coming to an end and the Allies were switching their attentions to the Pacific theater and the conflict against the Empire of Japan, Vito Genovese was informed in Italy that he was to be shipped back to New York, where he would be prosecuted for ordering the murder of an associate, Ferdinand the Shadow Boccia, back in 1934. He had been under arrest in Italy for months on charges of black market smuggling there, and now learned that he would face the other charge in New York. Returned to America, he quickly managed to undermine the case by having several key witnesses murdered. His release from prison in June 1946 created a problem. Costello had been in charge now for nearly a decade, and with Luciano back in Italy, was the de facto head of the Luciano crime family. But he had taken over from Genovese when he had fled from the US back in 1937. As such, there was an argument to be made that Costello should relinquish power back into Genovese's hands. This he didn't do. Accordingly, while all might have been smiles and goodwill as Costello led Genovese to the place of honor at a table during a dinner organized to welcome him back to the US in 1946, in reality, the next decade would constitute a period of extensive rivalry between Costello and Genovese for the preeminent position within the Italian-American mafia in New York City. For a time, there was a possibility that Luciano might reassert himself. Having been deported back to Italy in February 1946, he soon absconded from there for South America and eventually turned up in Havana, Cuba, in October of that year. The mob had very extensive interests here in gambling and other vices. But as an independent country on paper, though one the US largely controlled in actuality, Luciano could legally enter Cuba. He quickly sent out word for the heads of the many Italian-American crime families from all over the US to meet in Havana for a once-in-a-decade meeting of mob bosses. Their Jewish-American associates were included, as Meyer Lansky, a close ally of Luciano's for 30 years, was central to affairs. They met in Havana on the 22nd of December, and the meeting went on over Christmas 1946. There, an extensive array of affairs pertaining to the Cosa Nostra and their allies in the US and in Cuba were discussed. We know in retrospect that Genovese tried to undermine Costello by intervening in private with Luciano to reappoint him as his deputy in New York. But Lucky angrily dismissed the idea. Costello was to remain in charge. And he would remain in charge. Luciano was unable to keep pulling strings from Cuba. Within a few weeks, the American authorities in Havana became aware that he was living in the city and began pressurizing the Cuban government to expel him. They eventually consented to this, and in 1947, Luciano returned to Italy. He would spend the last decade and a half of his life living there, removed effectively from his role in New York affairs. One of the major issues under discussion in Havana had been Bugsy Siegel, a close ally of Meyer Lansky who had been central to extending the mafia's gambling operations out west. He had been placed in charge of the development of the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas as a collective mafia interest, one which had been invested in by families from all over the country. But Siegel had gone rogue, mismanaging the construction and opening of the Flamingo and lining his own pockets in the process. Siegel was killed months after the Havana meeting after a collective decision was reached, but there was much management to be taken care of in terms of Las Vegas. Costello was involved to a significant extent. Once matters turned around, millions of dollars started to flow in, so much so that new hotels and ventures in Las Vegas were soon being planned by the mafia. Costello was clearly central to the development of the Tropicana Hotel, which was built in the 1950s with Phil Castell, the mob associate who had run Costello's slot machines down in New Orleans for years, moving to Las Vegas to oversee much of the activities around the Tropicana. Years later, when Costello was shot in New York, police retrieved a note from his coat pocket which provided details of the Tropicana's earnings and showed his centrality to affairs in Las Vegas, though it couldn't be proven that he was any way involved in illicit activity there. In the post-war period, Costello became widely known as the Prime Minister of the Underworld, a reflection on his position as the effective head of the most powerful of New York's five families, and also his decidedly political nature. This reflected his personality too. He and his wife Bobby lived in a relatively unglamorous lifestyle by comparison with many other mafia couples. They never had children and spent much of their time socializing on the weekends, though not in a lavish way which would garner attention. Often he would spend time in the company of people beyond the social circles of the mafia. The owner of the Newsday newspaper on Long Island, Alicia Patterson, once recounted how Costello approached her one day in a restaurant of the Waldorf Astoria and noted they were neighbors and invited her and her husband for cocktails some Saturday. They took the invite and later noted that there was nothing to suggest Costello was a crime lord. He was an affable host, personable and polite. The only thing that was perhaps any way out of the ordinary was when Frank rang a bookmaker and placed $3,000 worth of bets on two baseball games and a horse race. It was how he lived typically, under the radar and much like any other wealthy New York businessman. In the late 1940s, Costello found himself in something of an embarrassing and potentially fatally compromising situation. In a real-life version of Tony Soprano, Costello began attending a Park Avenue psychiatrist by the name of Richard Hoffman in 1947. Hoffman was well known. He specialized in alcoholism and famously tried and failed to treat F. Scott Fitzgerald, the author of The Great Gatsby, back in the mid-1920s, right around the time his magnum opus was published. By the 1940s, Hoffman was a regular guest on radio and television shows and had something of a public profile. Costello happened to meet Hoffman by chance one day in Central Park, and after they got talking, he decided to attend him professionally to deal with periodic bouts of depression which he had suffered from for many years. The sessions went on for 2 years. Exactly what was discussed was necessarily secretive. In any event, the sessions came to an abrupt conclusion in 1949, when Hoffman publicly revealed that Costello was a client of his and he had recommended that he treat his depression by associating with a better class of people. It was an embarrassing revelation for Costello, given the mafia's code of silence. He denied ever having visited Hoffman, and the incident was soon behind him. Yet he cannot but have created questions in the minds of some of his New York colleagues as to what he might have revealed to Hoffman over the 2 years. The risk of exposure, which had appeared with Hoffman's revelations in 1949, became much more acute in 1951, when Costello was summoned to appear before the government Kefauver hearings into organized crime in America. Such hearings were a tricky thing to handle. On the one hand, figures like Costello didn't want to incriminate themselves or any of their associates. But on the other side of things, they didn't want to get caught in a lie and face a perjury charge. Costello's entire life came under scrutiny. For instance, they went back to the name acrobatics he had engaged in before the courts in his youth, querying whether he had ever gone by the name of Frank Saverio, as he had done when arrested on a gun possession charge in 1915. They also questioned Costello on how his slot machines ended up all over New Orleans in the mid-1930s, to which Frank answered plainly that he had agreed to make donations of $40,000 per year to charities of Huey Long's choice in return for permission to do so. Yet what was mostly troubling the hearing members was Costello's links to Tammany Hall and New York's politicians. At one juncture, Costello walked out of the proceedings. When he came back sometime later, he was asked by one of the committee members if he had done anything as an American citizen which he was proud of. Costello dryly answered that he had paid his taxes. It was a statement which he would quickly come to regret. The Kefauver hearings had ended in little concrete action. They had, though, resulted in a greater commitment by the government and federal police to prosecute leading members of the Italian-American mafia. They went after Costello in the same manner in which Al Capone had been attacked 20 years earlier: tax evasion. In 1952, shortly after he had appeared before the hearings, efforts were undertaken to charge him with tax evasion and to strip him of his American citizenship. In the months that followed, they managed to compile a dossier which suggested that he had not paid taxes on hundreds of thousands of dollars of earnings, which they could accurately tie to Costello. While some of his businesses were discovered to have financial irregularities in the accounting books, prosecution began, and in the end, Costello was sentenced in the course of 1954 to 5 years in prison for his tax issues. He was not taken into custody immediately, though. On what was a conviction for a non-violent crime, he was able to remain at liberty while his team of lawyers began appealing the decision. It hung, however, like a sword over him for much of the 1950s, always waiting to learn when he might actually have to go to prison for a period of time. By the spring of 1956, Costello's legal team had exhausted its options. In a last desperate effort to avoid prison, his lawyers put forward a striking petition. Their client, it stated, was an elderly man who was suffering from both a serious stomach ulcer, which was true, and a likely fatal form of cancer, which was a complete fabrication. Placing him in prison on tax evasion charges was cruel in the extreme under these circumstances, they contended, and so they requested that the charges against Costello be dropped. In return, he would voluntarily leave the United States. This was a major offer. Though born in Italy, Costello had never known anything other than New York, where he had lived since he was 4 years old. Presumably, he intended to head back to the old country, where Luciano and many others had ended up after their time in the United States came to an end. In any event, the offer wasn't accepted. Consequently, on the 14th of May 1956, he surrendered himself and was sent to the state penitentiary in Atlanta, Georgia, to serve out his sentence. There, he quickly hired a new lawyer, Edward Bennett Williams, who managed to file an appeal showing that some of the evidence collected against Costello was done so in an illegal fashion. Thus, in March 1957, he walked free from prison after serving just 10 months of his 5-year sentence. Costello's conviction for tax evasion and brief imprisonment had convinced Genovese that he was finally going to be able to take over as the head of New York's most powerful crime family, and when it was all scuppered and Costello was released, he decided to act in another way. On the night of the 2nd of May 1957, Costello was at a social gathering in Manhattan when he told his friends there that he needed to head briefly back to his apartment at the Majestic on West 72nd Street, overlooking Central Park, to take a phone call from his lawyer. At about 10:55 p.m., his driver pulled up outside the Majestic building. Unbeknownst to Costello, at exactly the same time, a limousine pulled up behind Costello's car. Out of it came Vincent Gigante, a former boxer turned mafia associate who was a protege of Genovese's. As Costello exited his car and headed into the foyer of the building, Gigante approached him and said, "This is for you, Frank," before shooting him from no more than 10 foot away. The bullet hit Costello in the head and he fell backwards. Gigante absconded immediately, thinking the deed was done. But he hadn't succeeded in his task. The bullet had only grazed Frank's skull alongside his right ear, and he made a quick recovery. Gigante was picked up afterwards once the doorman of the Majestic provided details to the police of his appearance. The case eventually went to trial. However, Costello refused to cooperate with police, and in a peculiar development, he and Gigante later became relatively friendly with one another. It was all in the nature of their business. In the weeks that followed, Costello considered his options even as Genovese tried to shore up his position by letting it be known that he had acted in the way he had because he had information that Frank had actually been released from prison in return for becoming a police informant. There was almost certainly no truth to this. Costello's two pathways forward were clear. He could go to war with Vito, or he could step aside. He chose the latter. One of the striking things about the history of the Italian-American mafia is how many people ended up dead or in jail simply because they never had the good sense to stop, even long after they had made more money than they could conceivably spend. Surprisingly few got out. One of the exceptions was Johnny Torrio, the head of affairs in Chicago in the early 1920s, who had the good sense to call it a day as the psychotic Al Capone began his ascent in the Windy City. Costello now imitated Torrio and relinquished control in the aftermath of his attempted murder. Perhaps this was an initial ploy, but when his ally Albert Anastasia, the head of the Gambino crime family, was murdered on Genovese's orders in October, just a few months after Frank's own close shave, it became permanent. Genovese now became boss and transformed the Luciano crime family into the Genovese crime family. He didn't enjoy it for long. Within 2 years, he had been convicted for 15 years on a drug trafficking charge, and in 1960, he entered prison. He would die in incarceration in 1969. While Costello had walked away from the mob life in many ways in 1957, the federal government hadn't walked away from him. On the evening when Gigante shot and nearly killed Costello, as he entered his apartment building, Costello had been returning home briefly to take a phone call from his lawyer. The government was continuing to see if it could send him back to jail on tax evasion charges, and was collecting new evidence all the time. Whatever they might have heard about Costello stepping back from affairs didn't temper their zeal in this regard. A final hearing on the matter was held in October 1958. It went against Costello. Thus, he was sent back to prison to serve out the rest of his term. He did this in Atlanta, so for a period of over a year, he and Genovese were incarcerated together in Georgia. There, by all accounts, they largely came to an amicable resolution of their former differences. Business was business, and the conflict was in the past. Costello walked long before his former nemesis. With the time he had already served in 1956 and early 1957, and the relatively limited nature of the crime, as well as time taken off for good behavior, he was made a free man again in the early summer of 1961. With his retirement in full swing in the 1960s, following his final release from prison, Costello settled into a fairly routine life. He would rise early and go for walks near Central Park. He continued to meet some old acquaintances who were actual friends rather than business partners regularly, sometimes dining out two or three evenings a week. Clearly, he was not worried about ever running out of money. However much had been stashed away in various ways over the years, added to some income which he still accrued from legitimate business interests. When he went to restaurants, he was known to tip the waiters and waitresses with $50 and $100 bills. Not a bad table if you could get it in the 1960s. On the weekends, he and his wife Bobby would head out of town to their other house. There, one of Costello's major concerns was his garden, which he invested a lot of energy in. All in all, it was the kind of retirement which might have been expected from somebody who had learnt to treat being in the mafia to begin with as a profession and not a lifestyle that he would die within. When he was called to testify in 1970 about gambling in the New York area, he answered the questions calmly and seemingly without hiding anything. The truth was, there was nothing to hide anymore, barring the odd occasion when an old mafiosi acquaintance would come to him looking for some advice. He had essentially left it all behind, and the police needed to look elsewhere for answers to their questions. On the 7th of February 1973, at home in his apartment in the West Side, overlooking Central Park, Costello suffered a heart attack which induced a seizure. He was packed off to hospital, where the doctors seemed to think his condition wasn't too bad. Yet they kept him in for a while, as he was now a man in his early 80s and they couldn't be too careful. While he was there, Costello contacted Peter Maas, a writer who had been in touch with him sometime earlier about writing up his life story into a book. It was a period in which there was enormous public interest in the lives of his generation of mobsters, and just over a year later, a book alleging to constitute the last testament of Lucky Luciano was to appear in print. The last testament of Frank Costello would never be written. He suffered another heart attack on the morning of the 18th of February, which killed him. The New York Times ran his obituary on the front page the following day, calling him the Prime Minister of the Underworld. A small funeral was held a few days later, attended by just over 50 people, as Costello's widow, Bobby, had requested that it not be attended by hundreds of mafia associates. He was buried in Queens. Costello may have been the shrewdest of all the mob bosses who rose to prominence during Prohibition and who dominated the mafia down to the 1960s. Even as he was retiring, authorities were beginning to investigate their activities to a much greater extent, with Senate hearings being organized to call figures like Genovese to testify on the role of the labor unions in organized crime. In 1963, Joseph Falacci would present astonishing evidence before these hearings, in which he revealed in extensive detail for the first time the existence of a national Italian-American crime syndicate which had been in existence for decades and which had been governed by a commission of bosses since Prohibition times. Although the glory days continued to some extent into the 1970s, the 1980s were the turning point as the mob's role in Las Vegas largely came to an end and huge numbers of arrests and successful prosecutions of leading figures in many cities were made, often because so many associates of the Cosa Nostra were being indicted on heavy narcotics charges and were turning state's witness. Although the mafia remains powerful in the US today, it is a shadow of what it had been between the 1920s and the 1950s, when Costello was at the very center of its affairs. Frank Costello was unquestionably one of the most significant figures in the history of the Italian mafia in America. Although there have been many important individuals within it since the late 19th century, the generation of criminals who came of age in New York in the 1920s, and from amongst which Costello, Luciano, and Genovese were critical, were unquestionably the most influential of all in shaping the organization and making it as powerful as it was by the post-war period. From amongst them, Costello was always noted for his intelligence. While Luciano made Genovese his second in command within the Luciano crime family in 1931, Costello became his consigliere, an advisor whom he turned to for advice at critical moments. In the end, his shrewdness was borne out by how their lives developed. Luciano ended up living much of the second half of his life exiled from the United States. Genovese died out in Kansas after spending nearly the last decade of his life in prison. A great many of their other associates died face down in their own blood. Costello had a lucky escape in 1957 when the bullet only grazed his head, but ultimately he had the good sense to know when to stop and he died quietly in New York in his 80s. What do you think of Frank Costello? Was he the kind of cerebral, unassuming mob boss who might have allowed the mafia to continue as a major concern if Genovese hadn't supplanted him? Please let us know in the comment section. And in the meantime, thank you very much for watching. Thank you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.